The laboratory is engaged in a number of cooperative research activities. To begin, the laboratory is presently associated with the Institute of Arctic Biology in conducting a study for Trans-Alaska Pipeline System Incorporated of methods which might be used to revegetate disturbed surfaces in Arctic and subarctic Alaska. This is a continuing study, and the facilities of the lab and the personnel will continue to be involved in this investigation. A number of cooperative investigations between the Soils Laboratory and the U.S. Forest Service are being conducted also. Nutritional studies with Sitka spruce and western hemlock are underway in southeastern Alaska, and primary productivity studies in alder stands on the Tanana River floodplain are nearly completed. Alder is a very important species in the successional regime with which white spruce is associated. White spruce is now the one species that is of economic importance in the interior. Alder has the ability to increase the fertility of the soil prior to the time that white spruce appears on the scene. One cooperative study entitled Snow Breakage in Black and White Spruce Stands in Interior Alaska showed that approximately 28% and 23% of the trees in local white and black spruce forests respectively were killed by heavy snow and ice storms which occurred during the winter of 1967 and 68. This amount of damage would represent a substantial loss of growing stock to forest property owners, and furthermore, an increased fire and insect hazard now exists in these forests. Another cooperative study is being conducted with the Fisheries Research Institute at the University of Washington. This is a reconnaissance soil vegetation survey in the Wood River Lakes area near Dillingham. The laboratory is also involved intimately with the International Biological Program activities of the tundra taiga biome. Laboratory facilities, including assistance of the lab personnel, are available for the use of undergraduate and graduate students at the university. An introductory course in soil science is taught by the laboratory personnel every other year. During the course, students are acquainted through lectures with physical, chemical, and biological properties of soil and how these components interact in soil development. In the laboratory, students have an opportunity to use sophisticated equipment and analytical techniques in becoming acquainted with soil properties. A continuing effort is being made to publish research results, and approximately four publications are now in the quote-unquote mill. Future laboratory activities and program expansion. Intensive forest utilization and forest management are not economically feasible in interior Alaska at the present time. However, Alaska is in a particularly advantageous position with regard to management of her forest resources. While most of the presently commercially valuable forest exists in southeastern Alaska, and this is estimated at about 5.8 million acres, it is estimated that 22.5 million acres of potentially commercial forest land exist in the interior. Only a small fraction of this resource in the interior is being utilized at the present. State and federal government agencies controlling this forest land have no scientifically based management plan for this potentially valuable resource, and no plan has been necessary in the past. The chance exists for a scientific basis to be established for forest management prior to the time that active utilization of the resource will occur. Basic information can be collected on biotic and abiotic factors in the forest environment which control forest development prior to the time this information is needed in the synthesis of forest management plans. To add to this body of information, the research activity of the Forest Soils Lab should be expanded to include detailed studies of nutritional requirements of the major forest tree species growing in Alaska. There's little information available on this subject at the present time. Information is available on nutritional relationships for the same species or species within the same genera but growing in the eastern United States, Canada, or Europe. This information, while serving as a guideline, cannot be considered as providing final answers to questions concerning the nutritional requirements of the various tree species in Alaska. Detailed laboratory physiological studies should be initiated in controlled environments to study the influence of light, temperature, moisture, nutrients on tree vegetative and reproductive structures and root development in order to develop a body of knowledge basic to the interpretation of environmental effects on tree growth. That concludes my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. John Teal will now tell us briefly about the Muskox project.
Thank you. not bring a sample for each of you, or a handout. It would have been possible this morning to provide you each with about two muskoxen. This is the sixth year of the muskox project at the University of Alaska, the 16th year of the project to domesticate the muskox, and the 23rd year of its more or less intensive investigation. And I'm pleased to be able to report to you that they are all, as of this morning, thriving. In fact, when I looked at the picture of that cow, it was somewhat hunched up, and I thought of the animals out there this morning at 30 degrees below zero, gambling about, or even earlier, lying, basking in the sun. What sun? I thought, what more does an animal have to do to tell you that it is the proper domestic animal for this type of an environment? Without running the risk of starting some internecine warfare, I should tell you that for years we have been going out to our station on Yankovich Road, past the University Agricultural Station, and this same thought has occurred to all of us every afternoon in the winter when we'd see cattle hunched up, more or less like these old paintings of the West, freezing beside the big manure pile there. And just a few yards away would be moose digging through the snow right up to the fence, happy, fat, and also saying, why aren't you working with us instead of these Southeast Asian animals? As of this morning, our muskox population out at the project is 64 animals. 33 of them were brought in three expeditions in collaboration with the Institute of Northern Agricultural Research in 64 and in 65. We started having calves in 1967, 1 year ahead of the normal schedule. We considered that our bonus crop. We have now had three complete crops of muskox calves. This last year has been rather an unusual one. We had, I think it was 18 females and 5 male calves born. This just doesn't happen even at Reno or at any gambling table. I'm sure that next year we'll have 18 males and 5 females. Of these, 2 were stillborns. The average weight for a calf at birth should be approximately 16 pounds. And we had one calf delivered dead at 33 pounds. Naturally, she couldn't make it. We've had this year one broken leg, which required a pin being placed, which meant that our calf was making regular trips into the hospital in Dr. Beckley's office downtown in Fairbanks. This will not be possible with the larger animals. The breeding season we have customarily set up to be the month of September each year. In the wild, the animals start breeding about mid-July and continue it through September. But we wanted to know precisely who was doing what to whom. And so September is their time, and May is their time of delivery. Each bull is provided with a harem, and it is all on a selective breeding basis. There are continual records kept on each animal. And this fall, for the first time in these 16 years, we have had the opportunity to try some inbreeding. We have never before gotten to the stage where you have brother, sister, father, daughter, mother, son. But we thought that since it worked so well for the pharaohs and other people, we'd try it with muskoxen as well. We have been able to find out which animals are the most productive, and we selectively breed for rapid growth, early maturity, and production of underwool or kiviut, which is their chief product. And we think that there were 26 females bred for production this coming May, early June. This, incidentally, is around-the-clock process for the men of our staff, who last year went 3.5 weeks, and I think never averaged over 2 hours sleep a night, because the animals we haven't trained to cooperate too well in this department. The most outstanding feature of the last year has been the setting up by our textile specialist of textile workshops, the foremost of which was on McCurrick, in the village of McCurrick on Nunavak Island. We thought that Nunavak and McCurrick were the appropriate places to start because these people have had muskox thrashing around them now for the last 30 odd years. They cannot have the domestic animals because they are surrounded by the wild ones, which would of course lead off the tame ones, make it dangerous to go out into your herd, assuming that, for example, that you were walking up to a tame or domestic bull and it turned out to be a wild and uncooperative one. Nevertheless, Ann Schell, our textile specialist, went there at the Christmas time last year, in fact was stuck there over Christmas, and she taught, I think, 12 to 15 women basic techniques of spinning, knitting, and weaving. Since that time, the number of women participating in the program has increased to 30, with 27 regular contributors. These women have been knitting scarves with wool which we have provided from here, and they have been sending it into the university. It has been going back with criticisms, instructions on how to improve their techniques and so forth. The designs that they are using have been taken from ancient archaeological artifacts which have been found in our museum here, because we have felt that it's important that they utilize their own artistic expressions. So you might say that as of this year, there have been a minimum of 27 families in Alaska making a significant portion of their income from the manufacture of muskox products. All of this has been possible primarily because of our staff. We have 9 people on our staff. 2 of them are supplied by the Institute of Northern Agricultural Research. 1, a Greenlander, who is training so that he may go back to Greenland and start a station there. And another, a graduate student from Cambridge University in England. We have, in addition, 40-odd collaborators in various other universities who help to carry out various research aspects of our program. As far as research is concerned, as you may recall, our grant from the Kellogg Foundation forbids basic research. We are supposed to be applying to practical needs the results of basic research. This is the term under which the Kellogg Foundation operates. Consequently, all basic research must be done either with Institute of Northern Agricultural Research funds or with contributions from outside. This year, the most interesting things have been, first of all, research in the realm of skeletal measurements. We have, for example, on a series of muskox skulls that we've collected from Ellesmere Island and from Greenland, made 157 measurements. But we have also decided that the majority of these are more or less meaningless. So a bull is 4 inches between his eyes, what does that mean? As a consequence, we have introduced these to a computer and reduced them to 5 what we consider meaningful measurements, which will tell you all sorts of things, such as how old the animal is, its condition, its sex, and whether or not it should be of interest to us in terms of domestication. The most interesting thing in terms of agriculture this year has been the way in which the wool has been collected from the animals. Each animal every day was plucked, if you will, from certain regions, 11 regions on its body, just as in sheep, and following the specifications of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. Every piece of wool from every animal was weighed and measured, and we are building up a classification system, just as in sheep or in goats and so on, which parts of the animal produce the best crop, the most crop, and so on. All of this, incidentally, will have to be introduced to a computer. The other thing is the behavioral studies. Each day, some 60-odd observations are made on every animal. These observations now total over $4.5 million, and we are stuck for computer services to run these through. This series of measurements, detailed measurements on these animals, probably is as long as has ever been done on any major mammal. We have coming out, accepted for publication at this point, 11 pieces to be published during the year 1970. As I said, the funding of our project is primarily here, the Kellogg Foundation, which very generously this year just renewed our grant for an additional 5 years at a slight increase, plus a secondary grant to pick up what we overspent in the first 5 years. In the terms of our renewed grant, we are supposed to concentrate primarily upon introducing the results of the muskox domestication to the villages in the regions for which it is most designed, i.e. the coastal regions of Alaska. As a consequence, I and two other members of my staff spend the majority of our time, and shall during the next 4 years, out in the villages. We receive requests from most of them. It seems almost weekly we get a resolution or a petition to have the muskox industry brought to them. We then go out and examine the village from many viewpoints, most of which are anthropological, social, or economic. We also hope, before these 4 years are up, to have established a substation in the coastal regions themselves, because we have not been blind to the fact that many native persons, in fact those who stand most to benefit from our project, do not like to come to Fairbanks. They much prefer to stay in their own home region. Thank you very much. If any of you should be interested in one of the products which the women of the village of McCarrick have made, I have a triple harpoon scarf which we've just received, and I'll lay it out on this table. Thank you.
John, thank you very much. Good job in catching up on schedule now. May I suggest, President, we reconvene at, is an hour adequate for lunch? Can we reconvene at 1:30?
Oh, that's
We better start, and we're going to ask Victor Fisher, who, as you know, is the director of the Institute of Social, Economic, and Government Research, to speak to his program.
Honored members of the board who are here, and I feel sorry for those who are not, because they'll miss a real education today. We have supplied each member of the Board of Regents with a copy of sort of a little fact book that hope will be useful in following this presentation. Also, we have an outline of our presentation in the beginning. What we hope to do, and I say we, because George Rogers and I will be making this presentation jointly, what we hope to do is go through as fast as we can with the essential aspects of our program, and then hopefully there can be time during which the regents or anyone else here will pick up any omissions that might have been with respect to our outline, and have any follow-through questions or have any other related questions or comments. I have somewhat prematurely put a slide on the screen to show graphically the growth of the Institute. The Institute was formed in 1961 by legislative action. During the initial period, the bar graphs would be so low that they would be indistinguishable from the baseline, so that we haven't bothered projecting it to the left of the initial fiscal year 65-66. But during the first period of the Institute, George Rogers was, in fact, the only member of the Institute. He's our grand old young man. And by 1966, when we start appearing on the screen, we had a staff of about four or five people. Within 2 years, by 1968 or so, spring 68, we had a total of about 55, 60 people on the Institute staff. Now we have managed to reduce the staff quantitatively to 30-some people. Qualitatively, it's substantially higher, and we had almost twice as many staff members. And anyway, this is just sort of background information. What I would like to initially briefly cover is the sort of essential purpose and direction of the Institute. It was established, as I mentioned, 61 by the legislature, primarily to develop information and statistics about Alaska, useful to the development of Alaska, at the same time to initiate programs in research in the social sciences. I might mention as an aside that initially the Institute was named the Institute of Business Economic and Government Research. It was renamed before I came on the scene in 66 to the present name Institute of Social, Economic, and Government Research. Once over lightly, we have further description in the first sheet on the introduction in the book, why a special institute of the sort in Alaska. And there are two basic considerations here. First of all, that the special characteristics of Alaska necessitate emphasis on original fact-finding, interpretation, innovation related to decision-making processes. Situation generally in Alaska with respect to the climate, population, economy, the institutional arrangements is in many ways so different that one simply can't pick up and copy what is being done elsewhere. And the second major consideration is that in part the same characteristics of small population, large scale, visibility of institutions and so on make Alaska an ideal laboratory in which to observe conditions and these institutions and processes which are unique to the state, and thus provide the social scientist with an opportunity to study some of these features in much greater depth. We have next a listing of institute research interests, which are in effect the research objectives, and I'll just list these very quickly. Regional national economic development, utilization of natural resources, interaction between man and the environment, technology investment in human resources and the ends of education, cultural change, cultural interchange, impact of these processes on personality, government institutions, intergovernmental relations, and political processes. We developed these a few years ago. We're constantly reinterpreting them, but these show the essential purpose. We next look at the areas of the operation of our research programs, and these are first and primary: Alaska, its subregions, its communities, its cultural groups, and its industries. Secondly, Northern North America, Alaska, Yukon Territory, etc. Next, the North Pacific Basin, including Japan and Siberia. And lastly, the North Polar region and the circumpolar lands. And I want to emphasize here that from the standpoint of social science research and operations, these are really arenas of research. These are not, there is no such thing as Alaska social science or a social science of the North. Again, this is where we have the laboratory situation and the application of the social sciences to a given region. We next list the service objectives of the Institute, which were generally expressed in legislation, have evolved since then. First, to provide data and information necessary to support activities and development in the public and private sectors, including collection, processing, and guiding of statistical and publishing of statistical data on the economy, population, government, and resources of a state. Second, develop improved techniques of economic analysis and business expertise to increase the quality and scope of Alaska business activity. Third, promote the exchange of information and personal contacts between University of Alaska and other institutions, and so on. Next, train personnel to carry on continuing research functions at the university and perform necessary community services at the local level. Next, to strengthen the academic faculty of the University of Alaska and assist in establishing graduate programs in the social sciences. Lastly, aid in bringing the University of Alaska to a stage where it can provide necessary support functions for local, state, and federal activities in the economic and social development of Alaska, and for more effective effective community planning and development. Now, as you listen to what I have read off here, you can read into this a reflection of some of the comments that were made here yesterday about the interrelationship between research and education and service. And in many ways, our institute is probably the other institutes, and possibly more so, is in effect a microcosm of the university as a whole in terms of covering research and a very major service component and strong relationship to the educational and teaching functions. I would like to briefly review a series of research projects as we've listed them here. We haven't gone back and listed all research, and these are really only the major projects, most of them carried out at the request of or in collaboration with various governmental agencies and scientific institutions. I want to run through these primarily to illustrate the character and scope of what is being done. First, a list of major projects completed in 1969, analysis of Alaskan regional inflation, which consists of a number of separate analyses, a study of Alaska reindeer herdsmen, where we supported a doctoral candidate who at that time was teaching the College of Business, Economics, and Government in his field research and in the publication of this report. We've completed a study on mineral policy in Alaska. It was issued as Mining and Public Policy. Next, a study of marketing chips for pulpwood from the Haines area of Alaska and forest utilization of alternatives. We prepared a survey manual for comprehensive urban planning, and this has been published and widely distributed nationally. Another major long-term study that was completed for the Federal Field Committee was the Northwest Alaska Regional Development Study, which we have issued in draft form only so far. The programs that we're currently moving to completion during the present quarter include the state and the local governmental system establishing area-wide government in Alaska. This again shows how the research function of the institute, some of it quite basic in its character, ties in with problem solving in the state and relates to future development. In this case, looking at the role of the state in guiding the development of the local governmental system, analyzing the whole history of the establishment of the boroughs, the present character and the problems surrounding local government, primarily, again, organized boroughs, looking at the problems of unorganized Alaska, and then moving toward the suggestions as to the type of relationship that needs to exist between the state and the local governmental system, how it might be structured, and so on. And this is in final draft now, and we hope to see it published very soon. We hope during this quarter to complete work on a long, I should say an old study, the Alaska Agriculture Study, which was carried out in cooperation with the Ag Experiment Station and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, looking, as it did, at agriculture in its totality, the potential for development, and primarily viewing it as from the economic standpoint. Next is listed Mendenhall Wetland Study, which is an interesting case study of a conflict between various forces relating to a land that some considered important as a transportation corridor, others considered important as a an area for wildlife preservation, and how that was handled, what the various institutional special interests interplays were. Also, we've just completed a study of the economic considerations and the control and management of water pollution in Alaska. This is the a study in the application of economic theory to management of water resources, a very important study. We are just also completing a study of community service manpower requirements in Alaska. What kind of people do we need to run our cities, to run the villages? What is needed at the state level to adequately serve communities of the state? Next, a lengthy list, and I'll just read titles here. Research in progress, and again, this is only partial list. Japan price study, Bethel housing impact study, evaluation of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative and Community Enterprise Development Corporation programs. And I might point out as an aside here that this is a very important type of a study where we, in behalf of a federal agency, are analyzing the impact, the economic, social, community impact of certain governmental programs, but in the process using this kind of an evaluation as a means toward obtaining basic knowledge about the communities of Alaska, about the impact of governmental programs upon the people, upon the economy, and so on. Then psychological testing of Alaska Native college students, educational, we have a program of educational data collection and analysis, undertaking a project of master planning for the Keystone Canyon Scenic Park area as a step toward establishing by the state of a state park in that region, analysis of integrated forest utilization in the Rail Belt area of Alaska, a continuing study of Native leadership organization. We have a continuing program under contract with the Alaska Higher Education Facilities Commission, where our institute is carrying on comprehensive planning for the commission in a series of separate components. We're undertaking a major economic analysis of Alaska fisheries, which is coming up with some very significant results in terms of uncovering the institutional barriers to development of fisheries, which in many, many ways loom much, much greater than some of the biological and technological obstacles that are retarding the development of fisheries in Alaska. Next, adaptation of the Eskimo to the urban social system, Alaska Native Language Project, and an Eskimo Language Project. This is being carried on in cooperation with Mike Krause and Ms. Reed. Dean Wolf referred to this yesterday. A study of urban acculturation of Alaska Natives, a continuing demographic analysis program. We hope to publish a series of monographs later this year. This type of research is disseminated through a publication program of the Institute. I'm sure everyone here is familiar with the research reports that we put out. We've just entered into an arrangement with the University of Washington Press, under which the press will publish several books for us, one being edited by Dr. Rogers, another one special annotated bibliography by Dr. Hippler having to do with Eskimo acculturation. The University of Washington Press is also undertaking national distribution of all of our research reports, some in the past ones and those in the future. It is certainly our hope that before too long the University of Alaska Press will be activated. We feel it is a tremendous detriment to the university, to Alaska, and to our institute in not having our own press to handle this type of material and quite a bit of other material that should be emanating from Alaska. Next, this covers just once over lightly the research component. Next, a major aspect of our work, service to state and community. We include in the fact book for the board a list of major publications to date, a listing of the review of business and economic conditions, which of course is one, the latter is a primary means for dissemination of information about Alaska to Alaskans, public and private, as well as disseminating information about Alaska outside the state. The Institute, of course, carries on all sorts of statistical collection and analysis, a variety of planning assistance to individual communities, to government agencies. We assist various organizations with program development. We list here, for example, we've worked with the Alaska Federation of Natives, assisting them in some of their economic development programs. We helped establish, on behalf of the Office of Economic Opportunity and the Community Action Programs in Alaska, the Alaska Planning and Evaluation Center. We ran it for them for a year and then spun it off as an independent center, in effect carrying on sort of an initiating function, but not carrying it on as an integral function of the Institute. We've worked at various times very closely with the Local Affairs Agency of the state, with the done quite a bit of work with the Alaska State Housing Authority and other agencies. We've, in this general category, undertaken studies for the city and borough of Fairbanks, dealing with the housing problems, population, economic projections. I might say that right now, we've been asked by the borough and the school people to initiate a continuing program of economic and population forecasting, and we hope to develop a methodology here which would be able to project annually the various components of growth and over, say, a 10-year period, and provide a basis for both public and private business planning through this kind of dissemination of data and analysis, and then have a continual updating and projection of this type of information. We've been very involved in various aspects, as probably many of you know, of community education participation here and there through the Alaska Science Conference, very deep involvement in the establishment running of Brookings Conference right now, working with the Fairbanks community on establishing a Brookings Conference for on the future of Fairbanks. As one example of it, other types of related activities that we carry on, we have a high-level specialist, probably one of the top men in the country, coming up from University of California week after next. His special field is natural resources disposal policies, and he will concentrate while here primarily on petroleum leasing and leasing policies and procedures. And while here, he'll be working with our institute, but also giving some public lectures, working with Tom Kelly's Natural Resources Department staff, in effect holding internal workshops with them, meeting with the legislature, and so on. Various of our people work with the, let me interrupt, Mac? Bell? President Bell? There are a couple of books here for you. A number of our people work directly with government agencies, such as Dr. Arlen Tussing has been working for the past year part-time as chief economist for the Federal Field Committee. He also worked as chief economist for 2 months for Bill Pecora, the director of the U.S. Geological Survey in Washington. George Rogers is working with the State Department of Labor in one of their very basic programs. In terms of advisory services to public officials, agencies, we meet with people. We sometimes think we do nothing else, participating in events such as the CAB hearings on the Trans-Pacific Route case, the forthcoming case on the Alaska airline system in Alaska, and so on. I don't want to go on too much here. In the area of teaching. Here, of course, we're involved internally through the process that was so well discussed yesterday of teaching research, research teaching. We've been working with various interns and trying to help promote some more programs. Several of our people were involved as faculty supervisor for a Wichi-sponsored internship program dealing in the area of economic development. This program will be renewed again this summer, and I assume we'll be again involved in that. Many of our people are involved in the actual giving of courses, seminars, and the like in various fields such as economics, anthropology, geography, business, planning, you name it. I believe that just in the past and current years, we've probably covered all the colleges except arts and letters, and we've even offered Dean Kine the services of one of our people there. And of course, then importantly, the research that we undertake is a continuing input to the whole educational process, both within the University of Alaska as well as in other universities. Various research reports and previous books by Dr. Rogers have been very widely used. Let me turn very quickly to staff. Concentration, of course, is on people and not on hardware. We don't have any rockets or ships to show you, although we got a very interesting clipping from Ottawa the other day, which showed the the ice-covered tug G.W. Rogers coming in from an icebound voyage. Very interesting description of how the importance of George Rogers has been recognized. They even named tugs after him now. But generally, of course, our concentration is on people, on an interdisciplinary professional staff. We have brief bios in here. Let me just quickly recap that we have about two, three people in political science. We have four economists at various levels. We have two people in anthropology, one in sociology, one in geography, one in forest economics, a recreation specialist, an education specialist, fisheries resources specialist, and the like, with various support people in these areas. One of our problems, I might say, is that in none of these have we achieved an effective critical size, which critical mass, which is a real problem for us. We, of course, have made very wide use in our research programs of faculty of the university. We've worked very closely, as I mentioned before, with Mike Krause, many, many members of the faculty of the department of the College of Business, Economics, and Government have used the Institute as their research vehicle. And I'll come back to that again briefly. I don't need to belabor this again because various other people mentioned yesterday the various programs that they're involved in, which were also interrelated with the Institute, such as MIRL and so on. We also have close working relationships with other universities, with people in other universities, such as, for instance, in our fisheries study, we have a close cooperation from people, University of Washington, University of British Columbia. We, in fact, have someone from the Bureau of Commercial Fisheries working with us, a staff member of the Federal Field Committee cooperating. On the AVAC CDC evaluation, we have someone from University of Alberta. We have someone who used to be on our staff, currently doing doctoral work in Anchorage, working with us. Now, there's so much to say on all of these, it's rather frustrating to be going through this briefly. Let me turn just briefly and quickly again to financing. Picture of the history is briefly outlined here. We have moved in a rather short number of years from a funding 65-66 of about $85,000 to the $1 million level this year and next. We have also very significantly moved from a 75% state funding to a funding level of 17 to 18% by the state over the last couple of years, which, by the way, and we'll come back to this at the end, is a very disturbing and I think in the long run could be a very destructive aspect. From the activities that I describe, you can probably tell that much of our work is very closely related to what is going on in Alaska, to the problems of Alaska, to the future of Alaska, both in terms of research and in terms of the service component. To us, therefore, the general fund is really the important funding pool of operations. And here, of course, we have funds that go into all of our service activities, into miscellaneous research, recruitment, program development, matching of federal research programs, and so on. And in this case, we have been very fortunate in having had a major Ford grant to the tune of about $550 million, which has carried us $550,000. Wishful thinking, which has carried us to date. It has helped develop the growth of our institute, but as you can see, the actual income which has resulted from this has substantially exceeded the $150,000 per year that we spent from the Ford funds over the last 2 years. But the important thing is that Ford is now on a decline, and that this will reduce the capability that our institute will have to provide, both in terms of growth, expansion of research, and provision of services. Now, I have on our presentation outline the category evaluation, and unfortunately I've run way over time for this initial part. But I do want to mention something that I was very conscious of in the discussion here, and that is the problem of institutional obstacles, bureaucratic jurisdictions. I was personally disturbed by flag waving that I heard from all sorts of directions, and it was really great to hear the very brief but extremely important statement that Dean Smith made yesterday about the integral, close working relationship that we have evolving and that we hope to strengthen in the future, whereby we view research and education as mutually supportive activities, and not that don't necessarily have to be both carried on within one or the other, but can be sort of mutually intertwined. We've in the past had various joint appointments. We're now recruiting on a joint appointment basis, and this is the kind of a general program and cooperative orientation that, of course, is important to the university as a whole. Again, there's much to say here, but I don't want to pursue it. I do want to make a point that our institute has been almost singular in the United States, in North America, in being an institute in the social sciences. Generally, if our institute had not been established as it was, thanks to various people, including George Rogers, back in 1961, as a cross-disciplinary social science institute, you would have had as many social science presentations as you've had in the physical, biological, and other sciences over these 2 days. This, of course, creates a real problem of growth. It'd be a lot easier to pick off something here and to argue for each one separately. There's a tremendous value in this interdisciplinary approach, multidisciplinary approach. And interestingly, we're finally coming out of the problem that we've had in getting separate funding from various sources. The National Science Foundation has just established a program which is almost designed as if they had been reading what we were doing and followed our outline, because it's an interdisciplinary grant program for work in research related to current socially relevant problems, or however they state it. Let me skip the whole problem of the tremendous demands that are put upon the institute, and just underline here a statement that we have about the controversial character of the social science research, that the controversy that has so often surrounded the research that we've done and the results that we've produced, of course, is a measure, criterion of the relevance of what we've been doing. This really indicates that what We've been doing is what people care about, what they understand, and whether they like it or not, of course, they respond to it. And we have been pursuing this kind of interaction. Now, we have much to cover, and we only have about half an hour left, and we had hoped to provide for half an hour of discussion. But anyway, as I mentioned, our founding father, and lots of people take credit for being founding father, the fathers, but having been around the scene at that time, I know that George played a very key role in it, is Dr. George Rogers, who will next take a look at the future of Alaska in terms of what it means for the development of the Institute.
I'll go back to my usual work.
Okay, fine. When Vic kept stressing the founding father bit, the old saying, it's a wise child that knows its father, kept reoccurring in my mind. I wondered what that meant. I'm going to take off from Vic's last point, which is the matter of the relevance of social science research and its controversial nature being related to change. And in Alaska particularly, Alaska has, of course, been characterized, if we were to pick one thing, it would be it's been characterized by change. Many of you in this room have been here 3 decades or more, and if you review briefly in your minds right now, you can rapidly recapitulate the sort of changes that have occurred. They haven't been minor. They've been very dramatic. Dramatic to the point where previous trends have been reversed or diverted, shifted, other trends have been set into motion. They've been very basic in that entire structures, the economy, the social structure, the political structure, have been changed and replaced by new structures. And as Vic says, social science research is, of course, attuned particularly and peculiarly to change. And because sometimes we anticipate or try to anticipate these changes or make more identifiable changes that have occurred, this becomes a threat to the status quo and we become objects of controversy. Also, frequently we turn out to be wrong, but that's beside the point. But running over this thing, there is need, therefore, for such an institute as we now have. And there's a need for its continuation and expansion. And I'll be getting into this in a moment, if I ever get beyond my introduction. We need, in this type of, this climate of change, we need, first of all, to get the benchmarks the past has provided us. Going back over the past, the shifts from, as I've characterized it in my books, from colonial Alaska to military Alaska, to something that is now emerging as sort of a natural resource, international Alaska. I've used these labels because, in this case, I think they have some meaning. Because in each of these decades in which these changes have occurred, Alaska's entire character has been altered by the forces that were at work. And as we approach the future, we approach a future in which further change is in prospect. And we need guidelines. And therefore, we need the sort of research we're trying to do in our institute, and I think we are doing. I won't review the past because, as I say, most of you have lived through it, and I think with a little bit of reminiscing, you can do this yourselves. But economically, we have shifted from an economy as we approached the 1940s, which was based upon very specialized exploitation of just a handful of resources. In fact, canned salmon and gold represented approximately 90% of the value of products produced by the Alaska economy at the time World War II hit us. World War II, we shifted from an emphasis or even a reliance upon natural resources for our economy to federal spending because suddenly the strategic location of Alaska became recognized and it was necessary to import people in great numbers, relatively, and to provide for them. And therefore, we had to provide for facilities, whether they're military or civilian, in a hurry. This carried us through approximately 2 decades. Now the two coming back together, natural resources and location, have come together to produce the third Alaska that within our lifetimes is emerging. A natural resource international Alaska, which combines recognition of Alaska's natural resource in the broadest sense, the natural resource base in the broadest sense, with its strategic location, coupled with technological revolutions that have occurred in transportation in the last 3 decades. And these have combined to produce this entirely new Alaska, which we are now approaching. On the political side, we've gone through a whole series of changes too, starting with the limited self-government, self-determination of territorial government, to the more fuller determination of statehood. And with this, we have had basic changes in orientation of our objectives of development. As a state, we can no longer limit the objectives of development to purely economic development. It has to be development that is oriented to the creation of an American polity in the North, which means a society, a political economy, in which we all take part, in which we live, and just not merely stay for a while to make our fortunes and depart. And socially, of course, the changes that have occurred have been immense, because our population base has changed. The population coming in now is more permanent in nature, instead of the sort of transitory population we had in the past. People are coming here to make their homes. I've lived here long enough to have a second generation, my two oldest children, with their families now living in Alaska and creating their own careers and their own lives in Alaska. A number of you have had the same experience going into possibly more generations, but this is, I think, is a basic social change where we sometimes are not aware of. There's more stability in our population. Our labor force is more locally provided than it has been in the past, and so on. And then, of course, we've seen the emergence of the Native political movement, which has been sort of spearheaded by land claims. Sometimes we look at this simply as a means of grabbing land or something of the sort, but it means something more basic than that. This is a social movement, which in a sense is akin to and an extension of all the forces that created statehood. It's a desire on the part of a segment of Alaska's population, a very significant minority group, to have more fuller participation and to have a higher status in what's going on. All these things are involved. Now, let's look at the future. And here I'm going to use a few charts. In the back of your books, there's an appendix in which the tables are presented, so you can refer to this after I've departed this scene. But looking, first of all, at the value of natural resource products produced in Alaska, starting from 1960 through 1970, and then looking to the future. You can see there that in 1960, the total value of natural resource products was something like $176 million. By 1970, this is based upon 1960 data and the anticipated increases for this year that we now have in hand or in the works, the 1970 figure will be approximately $600 million value of natural resource products. And then looking to 1980, just another 10 years, we jump up to something like $2.6 billion. This last figure, by the way, I consider to be conservative. The petroleum input there is based simply upon the capacity of the Trans-Alaska pipeline system. And of course, most of the developers on the North Slope are expecting that the field will be much larger than that and that other means of getting the product out will have to be provided. Furthermore, I have only put the value of petroleum and natural gas at the wellhead. That takes me back a few decades, wellhead. wellhead price. I have not included in that figure any value for value added by manufacturing, which could be tremendous. And we do have, as we all know, in the last 5 years, the nucleus of a very important petrochemical industry complex developing in Alaska. Now look at the next slide, translating these impacts, or rather, this next slide is the foreign trade component in Alaska's economy. Going back just a few years, foreign trade didn't mean anything. It generally meant goods that are being transported through Alaska territory to Canada and vice versa. But after World War II, as I say, Alaska's strategic location in terms of other markets than the domestic markets became known and exploited, and Japanese investors were very quick to take advantage of this. The exports have risen from 1960, the exports were approximately $19.5 million. By 1970, they will be approximately $70 million. And by 1980, $350 million. Again, that 1980 figure, I consider to be a very conservative figure. I'm just putting it in here to give you an indication of the trends rather than the actual amount that we might achieve. But the important thing here is to recognize that one of the dynamic forces in current Alaska development is the foreign trade factor. This was not a force before the decade of the 50s, but it's going to be increasingly a force in our future. And as I say, this I feel is a rather conservative picture. The import side of it The big peak there represents, of course, the import primarily of pipe from Japan, other things from Japan in connection with the petroleum development, and this is anticipated will drop off and the imports will more or less level off. The imports, by the way, and the exports are direct to Alaska. They do not include exports of Alaska materials which pass through the continental United States and go to foreign markets, or foreign goods that come via this route. These are exports and imports directly from and into Alaska ports. And let's say this represents something of a downgrading of the total effect. Now, the third chart is an attempt to translate this into population growth. Magnitude of the expansion of population is anticipated to be somewhat less than the rate of increase of the value of products. And this is because of the nature of the development. It's going to be a highly industrialized type of development, highly automated, the capital intensive type of development. But nevertheless, it will result in a rather substantial significant increase in Alaska's population. In 1960, Alaska's population was about 228,000 people. This represented roughly the peak of military Alaska. The population growth from about 75,000 people in 1940 to this level could be attributed almost directly to military factors. The 1971 population I've anticipated is about 320,000 people. This is based upon current estimates of for the year 1968 and 69 preliminaries and anticipations for the future. But then going ahead to 1980, it will be somewhere between 400,000 and 500,000 people. I've used a range here because we still are uncertain about the types of developments that will be associated with the petroleum developments. And this range, of course, indicates the need for further research, which I am now engaged in with the Department of Labor, to try and get better measures of the occupational structure of the new industries that are forming up in Alaska and their population effects. The next slide looks more at labor force, and this gets back to what I told you about. The labor force will increase into the future, but the increase will be relatively modest as compared with the value of products produced, because the types of developments are going to be rather large-scale developments with heavy investment of capital. But nonetheless, new jobs will be created. And then the final figure, which we have here, is an attempt to analyze the personal income the development will generate for resident Alaskans. This gets out of the picture the types of income that go to outside investors. This is what remains in Alaska, basically. In 1960, this was estimated at $649 million. At 1970, I'm anticipating that it will be something in the nature of $1.5 billion. And by 1980, it may go up as high as $2 billion. And so you can see that Alaskans will increase in number and increase in per capita wealth as a result of these developments. Now I'm through with the slides. We can turn it off, Vic. Now, what do these changes and trends mean in terms of the sort of things we're concerned with? Both the Brookings Institution and the Alaska Science Conference were concerned with treating these very broadly and in a public forum. But we are engaged in very specific and detailed attempts to study the impacts. I'm not going to go into this now, but there are several things that emerge from our look at the future. One is that Alaska's future is going to be characterized by increased industrialization of the economy, very heavily capital-intensive type of development, as I said. And with this, we'll be going a rapid increase in urbanization of Alaska's population. Alaska's population has always been rather urbanly oriented, but this is going to be even further increased by the nature of the developments. The fact that the initial harvesting will take place in a scattered way, it will be pulled together for processing at central points and for transshipment. There will be continuous, if you broke these figures down by regions, there will continue to be regional diversity within Alaska, which means that Alaska will present all sorts of opportunities for different ways of life we might lead, and also different sets of problems.